think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Green, climate change, climate politics. I welcome Joseph Sternberg, member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. He writes political economics. He's based in London. And he's looking at what climate change politics have done to two parties or more in the United Kingdom. We begin in Scotland, where I spent a very happy year in seminary once upon a time. Since then, the Scottish National Party has changed the politics. And yet, Joseph, a very good evening to you. Welcome back from your journey overseas. But now that you're home, Scottish National Party has, as they said of the Weimar Republic, it first was murdered and then it committed suicide. What happened, Joe? Good evening to you.
Hey, John. So the thing to understand is that although Scotland is part of the United Kingdom, it enjoys a lot of what are called devolved powers. This is authority that the Scottish government gets from the United Kingdom central government in London to manage Scotland's own affairs. And it, crucially, one of these areas has to do with climate policy, such as carbon dioxide emissions to combat global warming or climate change. And that turned out to be the thing that brought down the most recent administration in Scotland, because you had had a coalition between two left-leaning parties, the Greens, and their much bigger partner, the Scottish National Party. And that fell apart because Scotland was trying to pursue very aggressive net zero carbon dioxide emissions targets to combat climate change. And the costs of this were starting to mount and become very evident to households. The Scottish National Party said, well, hang on a sec, we don't want to go in to a national election that's expected later this year, having to defend all of these insanely expensive policies that we foisted on Scottish households and voters. So they pulled out of this coalition with the Green Party and are now in the middle of a lot of Baroque leadership turmoil that probably isn't really interesting to anyone outside of Scotland and probably isn't very interesting to many people inside Scotland. But the key point is that this is just another example, and we have a growing list of them, of politicians who discover that although voters might tell opinion pollsters that they really support doing something about climate change, as soon as that doing something involves households having to pay steeper costs, the enthusiasm drains away very rapidly. And the Scottish administration is the latest set of politicians to have to grapple with the political fallout from that.
The other party that's in trouble with climate change, we learn within hours at the Financial Times, is the government itself. UK's government climate action plan is unlawful. This, according to the High Court, because it's pie in the sky. It's not real. It's being challenged by parties on the left who say that the Tories have given us a policy that sounds okay, but in fact is not credible. Joe, is this happening everywhere in Europe, or is it just limited to the United Kingdom and the double talk of the SNP and the Tories?
If memory serves, there have been a couple other cases, legal cases in parts of the European Union where the courts also stepped in to try to mandate more climate change. And we should expect a lot more of this kind of activity moving forward for a couple reasons. On the one hand, we have this phenomenon I was just describing where elected governments are realizing that the voters who elect them don't want to pay for this stuff. You were talking very intrusive, very expensive mandates about the kind of car you can drive and how you can heat your home and get your hot water from and what kind of food you can eat. And voters just don't want to do it. So on the one hand, elected politicians are going to naturally enough try to respond to that by dialing back some of these net zero policies. The problem is that back when they thought voters wanted this, these same governments very foolishly often passed laws that said we are legally committing ourselves to net zero. And so that is going to give environmental groups an opportunity to try to wage a rear guard action to try to sneak in through the back door in the courts the kind of environmental policies on climate issues that the public is not prepared to do through the front door in the democratic process. So I think this is still going to be very messy, and it's a warning that even if politicians start to see the light on the bad cost-benefit trade-off of a lot of these climate policies, it's not going to be straightforward for them to try to ditch that.
I enjoyed discovering, as Joe will help me understand, that it suddenly came to European governments that by urging people, subsidizing people, pushing them, tisking them to buying electric vehicles, they were creating a hole in their source of revenue because taxes are way down on fossil fuels for automobiles. Joe, it didn't occur to them before. Is there anything they can do about it? They look to be panicky.
Yeah, this is going to become the next big political battle because, we've just spent a few minutes talking about the bad politics when, you know, households discover that they will have to pay more in the future. Well, this EV issue and road taxes is a twofer in that regard because, consumers were sold on the idea of paying more for more expensive electric vehicles instead of buying cheaper internal combustion cars, because they were told that at least then they wouldn't have to pay fuel taxes. And these taxes are very steep in Europe. Europeans are accustomed to paying two or three times as much, even four times as much for a gallon of gas as Americans pay at the pump. And so these taxes are major revenue raisers, and EV buyers were told they wouldn't have to pay them. And now governments are discovering that they will have to pull some kind of bait and switch, because otherwise, where is the revenue going to come from? So people who had paid a lot of money for electric vehicles thinking that they wouldn't have to pay fuel taxes are about to discover that they'll have to pay some other form of tax, whether it's a road usage tax or congestion taxes, but there will have to be something because the revenue will have to come from somewhere. And that's going to be another big political oops moment when voters figure that out.
And now we come home to America. Having enjoyed ourselves mocking our European friends, we ask, is the Biden administration paying attention to these ironies? And Joe, my conclusion from reading your column is no, they're going ahead with the idea that we can mandate a switch to net zero and that it will not be a revolt in the population. Is that correct so far?
Yeah, that's the big head scratcher here, because, I mean, these governments that are reversing course in Europe are generally not very right wing. Even the conservative government at the national level in the UK that has dialed back some of these things, it's a very centrist, even kind of liberal party at times. So what I can't quite understand is why the Biden administration isn't getting with the program right now and realizing what a potential liability these things are. And the only thing I can figure is they're probably assuming that the election in November is going to be very close, and they can't afford to alienate their green voter base, which may or may not be true. But what Europe is discovering is that pandering to that green base inevitably means that you alienate a lot of other voters. So this could still turn out to be a pretty bad political bet for Team Biden.
Joe has written a column about Liz Truss. Yes, it, I understand. It's a crossword puzzle entry here. Truss, which would be five letters, a very short time as prime minister. However, as I recall at the time of Liz Truss's ascendancy and then descent, there was a Bank of England scramble and a panic in the pound that Joe at the time identified as nothing to do with Truss, but I learned from him that that is still an opinion that's not been explicated for the British people. Is that correct, Joe? They still don't know that there were it was a coincidence of timing.
Yeah, Liz Truss is back in the news right now because she recently published a memoir called 10 Years to Save the West, where she is trying to put forward her view of what happened in all of the market turmoil and her policy agenda and then the process that led to her ouster after only 44 days in office. And I think the key problem here is that there are a lot of unexplained mysteries about that period. There's a lot that we don't understand about what precisely caused the market turmoil. A lot of it probably had to do with Bank of England actions rather than the tax cuts that Liz Truss proposed. There's a lot that we don't understand about the Bank of England's attempts to stabilize the financial markets and the economic and political effects of that. What has been startling and very disappointing to me is that, for the most part, the media has not been interested in asking any of these questions. So when Truss's book came out, there was a lot of attention paid to the kind of clunky writing style, which is inevitable in most political memoirs, or the size of the advance that she got from her publisher, any of the picayune details that are included in the book. Still, at this late date, very few reporters seem to be at all interested in the actual economics of what happened. And that makes you wonder if Britain is going to be able to do any better until people figure out what actually happened in 2022.
And my memory also is that she and her Chancellor of the Exchequer, Mr. Quartung, were introducing programs that are entirely recognizable to us here in the United States. It was, as I recall, Joe, it was something like Reaganomics. Do I remember correctly?
Yes. I mean, their whole theory was that the British economy has a supply side problem, that investment is too low, productive output is too low. And so you need a bunch of tax and regulatory red tape reforms to try to unlock investment. And so what they were trying to do with these tax cuts was actually deliver a package of fiscal policies that would stimulate the kind of investment that the British economy so badly needs. And what I find crazy, really, is that although she has a lot of critics, none of them are offering a theory of the British economy that is as coherent or plausible as she is. It's almost as if they don't even try. And that says to me that Britain really hasn't learned very much from the Truss experience, because that event should have triggered a lot of curiosity about what happened and a real desire to develop some kind of alternative understanding, if there is one. So, you know, basically what we're learning is that Britain still has a long way to go.
And the critics, as you cite in your column, have enjoyed themselves finding new adjectives in derision of Liz Truss's book. Is this because they're not ready for Reaganomics, or is it personal? Can you tell, Joe?
I think they just find it easier to mock than to understand. I mean, I don't want to get into media criticism here because it's very boring for anyone who's not in the media, but I will say that when I am reviewing a book, I feel like I owe it to readers to engage with the argument that the book is making and then, you know, say whether I agree or disagree with it. But apparently a lot of the people who have been writing about Liz Truss's book don't follow that rubric, and they're really doing a disservice to the British voters and the quality of the discussion about these economic issues over here.
I love The Guardian. Shamelessly unrepentant, petulant, politically and economically jejune. Jejune is a word you choose when you're impressing people. Otherwise, it means simple-minded. Joe, my memory also of Liz Truss is that she arrived back in London in a state of a crisis And what you've identified is that there was no crisis, had nothing to do with her or the office at the time. Did they know then? Did the party elders who were exercising their right to choose someone else, and they choose Sunak, who's been okay, did they know at the time that it wasn't her?
I think that there was a lot of confusion at the time about what was going on. And what's perplexing is that there has not been very much curiosity after the fact. And I think that's because politically, this narrative that the market chaos was entirely her fault has been too convenient for too many people.
And I wonder if one of those people is Boris Johnson. We're going to turn to life in London. Joseph Sternberg, member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. He's in London. He writes political economics. He also observes that London is going through much the same turmoil as the U.S., but times 500 because the population is more dense, is denser, and especially because the protests in central London have been going on since the beginning, 6 months now. But the campuses are now alert as well to anti-Semitic conduct. When we come back, life in London. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.